This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Louise Candlish, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Louise is in France, which we all admire, I'm sure. such a beautiful country, isn't it?
It really is. It's kind of riot torn at the moment because Everyone's out on the streets protesting. But where
of
I
course.
Am is where I am is a kind of almost like a little Truman Show style island. Mm. So there's no sense of that. There's no sense of unrest here, which is good. But I've been following it on the news.
I was there last year. I was in the south of France last year. And do you know what I thought? I think I even wrote a little Instagram post on this. How French the French are. Don't you think?
They are. Yeah, they are. Yeah. They have no problems. They have no identity issues, as many other cultures seem to, certainly in the Anglosphere. I think, and maybe the language is a part of that. But yeah, they're very... They're very French. Yeah, they're very French. And,
that's right.
You know, they're resistant to being anything
And they're
else.
Fiercely French as well, which I quite love. Okay, Louise is the internationally best-selling author of 15 novels, including The Other Passenger, The Heights and Our House, which won the Crime and Thriller Book of the Year at the 2019 British Book Awards and is now a major four-part TV drama. And we're talking to Louise about her latest novel, The Only Suspect, is perfectly executed thriller and an unpredictable ride that will enthrall both fans and new readers alike. Do you know, 15 novels is a really big body of work, isn't it?
It is, and actually, this is my 16th, so it's kind of 15 previous novels. So, 16 novels and a novella. Yeah, I mean, when I think back to when I started writing fiction, I would never have imagined that I would reach this stage because I would not have imagined that I would have this number of ideas. So that has been the nicest revelation for me as a human being is to discover that I am just constantly having ideas and constantly thinking of interpreting the world through a new story.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds crazy when you say that number of books. And, you know, obviously we all know authors who've written 20, 30, 40, 50 books, and then you get to, you know, Agatha Christie and that kind of author where, you know, there are hundreds of works, and it's just incredible. The human mind and human creativity is really a thing.
Yeah, and then I talk to some authors that write a book every 5 years or have only written two or three books, not only because, you know, it can't be easy.
Yeah, and they're often amazing.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a personality thing. I'm the kind of person who gets bored quite quickly. I love ideas, but I'm not so keen on executing them. And I found that when I have been given extra time, because it is generally a contractual thing, you know, someone like me is writing a book a year or a book every 18 months because I'm legally obliged to. I've signed a contract and, you know, I'm going to fulfill it. Otherwise, you know, if you have an open-ended situation, I think you could go on for 10 years.
Yeah.
But I'm the kind of person who gets bored. So after about a year of working on anything, I want to move on. So it kind of suits me.
Mm-hmm. I spoke to Lee Child a little while ago now, and he told me that every time, because he's probably up to book 20, I'm not sure, but it was a lot of books.
Oh, many more, I think. Yeah.
Many more. Yeah, but he did say to me, and I wonder if this applies to you, he said that each time he sits down to start a new book, it's as hard as the first book.
I mean, it is in a way. It's certainly not, if you're giving it your heart and soul, then it's not a formula. It's not something that you kind of are doing by numbers and you know which ingredients you need to do, and you could kind of almost do it on autopilot. I don't think many authors operate in that way. I think it really does feel like reinventing the wheel. And I'm the kind of author I've discovered I like to do something different each time. And I really feel very strongly that I want to offer something new and original, in a way to read.
Because you don't want to be bored yourself, do you?
No, yeah. I don't want to be bored myself. But also I don't want to be accused of doing the same thing. And I just don't want to disappoint readers. So yes, it does feel like it's your first novel every time, but I think that's really good because that suggests a really refreshing soul to your work that, you are, you're really giving it all. And so I know exactly what he means. And there's also the fear as well, of course. You know, it's not just, pride in your ideas and originality. It is also just that fear that, you might never be able to bring it the way you did with, everyone's favourite book. I think when you have a big hit as well, that makes it even more difficult because everyone's comparing your next book to the one that went before or the, their favourite 5 books ago or whatever.
Do you know, I feel as though it's a career in a way that, is no win because you can't celebrate the wins. Because like here you've got such a body of work, you've got a TV show. Well, one of your books has been made into a TV show, but you can never rest on your laurels because what it is that's coming up is a new thing, and it's the fear yet again of how people respond to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's exactly it. You can't rest on your laurels. People will say to me, oh, it must be fine now, you're established. But, I don't
feel established. What is that?
And I don't know that anyone actually does, really. I mean, maybe when you're right at the end of your career and you've won multiple awards and you're a billionaire, I'm sure J.K. Rowling feels established. I think that those kind of megastars feel established. But I think for most of us, you don't. You feel like you're only as good as your last sales figures. You feel like, your next book is going to be your best one and it's going to be the best idea and the one that's going to change the world. But I think that's part of the process. I really do. I think if you did start to think, oh yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, this is fantastic.
With my name on it. I mean, that's dangerous territory, isn't it?
Oh, terribly. And yes, of course, they love me so much. Okay, I want to go back to where the writing started. Let's go right back and tell me how you came to writing fiction.
Well, I was one of those kids who wrote little novels. And, obviously this was back in the 70s and 80s. We didn't have the internet. And we had three TV channels. I don't think I had a TV in my room. Mm. I also was quite a naughty child and I got into trouble. We won't go into the details of it, but it was bad enough that my parents grounded me one summer. I was about 11 or 12 then, I think.
Oh, wow. And that's, early.
So it's about six weeks of not being allowed out except to go to the library. So, they did a good thing there because all I did was read and write that summer. And I wrote my first novel called Chopping and Changing. But then, obviously I grew up, I started working and paying rent and partying in the 90s.
And what were you working at? Were you working in a writing role?
Yeah, I was generally in editorial roles. So I started off working as an assistant on a travel magazine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then I moved to illustrated art books, so nonfiction, so a completely different world. And then I worked as a copywriter for an ad agency. So I was always dealing in words. Mm. But, kind of 20 words or 60 words. Or,
not 90,000
words. 1,000
words,
but yeah, not a novel. And then when I was, and I'd completely, sort of forgotten about fiction then. That was very much my kind of teenage delinquent hobby. But then I was a bit burnt out in my early 30s and I took a career break and I went backpacking in Sicily for just two months. It wasn't a big deal. And my boyfriend came with me for the first 2 weeks and then I waved him off and I was on my own and I was pretty much on my own sort of traveling for the first time in decades. And by the second day, I'd bought a notebook and a pen because I was bored and just had this idea inspired by where I was. I have to say that setting has always been a big thing as it is for many authors. And I just started writing a novel and it was about a woman who was stalking her ex-boyfriend on holiday with his new girlfriend. And it was just so much fun. It was not in any way an attempt to create a new career. I didn't really think about, you know, it being anything other than something I was writing, you know, old school in a notebook with a pen. But, you know, it kind of took over the trip. And by the time I went back, I thought, I'm going to type this up. This all sounds really kind of like I'm grew up in the 1950s, doesn't it? I'm going to type this up and I'm going to, you know, send it off to agents. So I did that and I got an agent and the book was published. So it was, it all seemed very easy. Like you could go on holiday and write a book and then suddenly you're an author. But as I've learned 16 books later, that was, you know, that really was just the beginning.
And I did you find that it was challenging to write long form after you'd been writing 20 words and 30 words and now you're writing, I don't know, what's a novel, 60, 70,000 words?
Yeah, I mean, this was the shortest of my novels. This was quite slight and, you know, it felt like a first novel. But no, I found it just enjoyable. And I think it's because I had had that conditioning as a young person of reading so much and, you know, and also having tried to write before. I mean, if I could write 50,000 words as a 12-year-old, then I could, you know, I could probably do it as a 32-year-old. But I think as with, you know, with all good writing and good reading, I just got completely sort of bewitched by the story. I just got, you know, absorbed into it as if that was, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be thinking about the fictional world. And it just happened very naturally and organically. And, you know, I always say to new writers, if I'm asked to speak to them or advise, I always say, really enjoy writing that first novel before you know if you're going to be published, before you know if you're going to get an agent. Just really enjoy it because it's such a pure relationship, you and the story. And you'll never have that again because, you know, as soon as you are a career author, there are so many other factors. You know, there is, as we were saying earlier, the legal obligation. You know, there's the commercial element. There's the, you know, being racked with fear and anxiety about sales figures. There's decisions to make about your career. But right at the beginning, when you've just had an idea and it's just you and no one knows about it, it's a really wonderful interlude in your life, I think.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you, because it's crime, isn't it? So did you think when you were writing that first book that this was going to be my path, that it's crime fiction that I'm interested in?
Well, no, because that book wasn't crime fiction. My darker stories didn't happen till about book 10. So before that, they were considered dramas, or in fact, that first book was considered a rom-com, even though it wasn't very romantic. It was, you know, as I said, somebody stalking somebody else. But it was a comedy. So there so early on, I wasn't crime fiction. It was only when I wrote The Disappearance of Emily Marr and The Sudden Departure of the Frasers, and I started to get categorized as domestic noir, which, you know, was an interesting sort of transition because there's no doubt about it that I was taken more seriously then, even though the writing quality and the books were, you know, exactly the same quality. And, you know, there's an ongoing argument about how disrespected women's fiction can be. And I think there's certainly a revolution happening here in the UK over that. And, you know, it's been outrageous. And, you know, I'm in a position to be able to compare how my books were treated when they were on two different shelves and yet they were ultimately the same sort of book. Anyway, so but that very first book was just my voice, which is generally quite lighthearted and but also sardonic. And, you know, it's comedic, but also, you know, there's a melancholy. And that, so that just reflected my personality. And then as I grew more confident and more experienced, I started to introduce elements to the voice that, you know, weren't necessarily my own. So I'd never made a conscious decision to become a crime and thriller author. That was a category that was sort of decided for me by publishers. I've always just written the book that I wanted to write at that time and explore the ideas that I had in my head at that time. So I think, and like authors like, say, Lisa Jewell is another one where, you know, she started out very much at the sort of, you know, one of the stars of Chick Lit, as it was called then. And now, you know, an incredibly dark, quite sinister storyteller. Well, stories are sinister. She's not sinister. Mm. But I think it's a similar kind of journey. And but neither of us, I think, would say that it was a conscious switch. It's a more kind of gradual darkening of the stories. And then, and I would say Our House, which was the one that you mentioned, won the Nibby, the British Book Award. That was probably the first time I actually conceived a story around a crime. Until then, the criminal elements had been sort of, you know, they'd instigated the emotional or psychological element of the story, but I hadn't really been quite so interested in the mechanics of how you committed a crime. So Our House was probably the one where you can say that was a real change.
I've always wondered, and I've talked to many, many crime authors, but, you know, I mean, they're dark places to be as a writer. How do you kind of move in and out of that?
It's just completely natural. I think that it's a rare person who doesn't have dark thoughts sometimes. I mean, you do get the occasional Pollyanna and, you know, I would love to live my life that way. But I'm definitely someone who's always been in touch with, you know, both the light and dark sides of my personality. So I just find it really easy to kind of dive under and then kind of reemerge and go for dinner and have a laugh.
Do you do research? Do you speak to people that have been involved in crimes? Tell me how the story comes to you.
My research will be will mainly be online or in terms of the setting, you know, going and absorbing all the details of a setting. But I don't talk to criminals directly. I have had advice from police officers when I want to get some procedural stuff authentic. But even that is very, very light because I write all stories from the point of view of someone who is either the victim of a crime or involved in a crime in a kind of hapless, incidental way where things have spiraled out of control. So I'm never thinking with the narrator never really has a sort of criminal mind in that respect. Mm. And I've never followed an investigation in a story. I've never done a procedural police story. So I'm always writing from the point of view of a regular person who has inadvertently got involved in crime. So in a way, it's better for me not to know. It's better for me not to know the technical language. It's better for me not to think about what's happening the way an investigator would or a detective. It's better for me to always keep in mind how I would, as a, you know, an innocent, crime-free person, I hope, would respond to that situation. So it's not necessarily that useful or necessary for me to go and talk to convicted criminals. But I do read an enormous amount of crime reports, and quite often it will be a feature about a crime that has inspired
the idea in the first place. Yeah, so you get your ideas from reading crime reports, yeah. So talk to me about winning awards and then, you know, then your book coming to life in another format, which is TV. I mean, it's a dream come true, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's only now that I've got several TV projects on the go and, you know, it's a brutal world, TV. Yeah. It's only now that I realise that just how unlikely it is for a project to be greenlit that I realise how incredibly lucky I was to, you know, have fallen in with Red Planet Pictures, who adapted Our House for ITV, and the screenwriter Simon Ashton, who did an amazing job, and the same team are now working on The Only Suspect, my new book that we're talking about today. So I do feel very lucky. And at first it was a bit surreal. I mean, I found it, the process of the adaptation and the filming and the casting and the creation of the sets and all of the location scouting, the whole thing was done in lockdown. So I was removed from the process, right. Which was a shame in a way. And I very much hope that with future commissioned projects, I can really get more involved in seeing how the whole process works in practical terms. But yeah, so I visited the set. I was able to do that. We were all masked up. And then obviously I saw some edited scenes, and then I was able to see the show before it was aired. Mm. It was quite surreal, I have to say. It was really surreal. Even just little things like the character names that I maybe had, sort of just made up on the spot with no thought whatsoever, now being, sort of used on, on screen with, 10 million people watching. It was just really strange. Mm. And of course, having a massive star like Martin Constant playing one of your characters is an extra layer of surreality, because he's so associated with Line of Duty, and I've seen him in various roles and he can do different accents. And it was just really strange to see such a familiar, sort of superstar playing my character. But interestingly, after about 10 minutes of watching, I just forgot it was anything to do with me. And I just sort of fell into the story like everyone else does. Yeah. So the self-conscious out-of-body experience didn't last very long. And obviously I had a nice glass of champagne on the go as well.
Obviously. Were you happy with it? Were you happy with the interpretation of your story? Because it is a different medium entirely, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. Mm. And I learned a lot just from reading Simon's scripts and seeing how you dramatize a story for the screen as opposed to offer it in a, in a kind of an interior sort of way that you do in a novel. He had said to me very early on that all of those meta elements that, actually made the book different and made the book I think helped win the book awards and be nominated for awards, the fact that it was based around a podcast, which was quite unusual at that time when I wrote it, and the fact that the recording of the podcast sort of is part of the plot, and then also the fact that there's a this sort of lengthy, almost suicide confession going on in there as well. All of those elements were going to be going, because they're of no interest to the viewer. They just get in the way of the story. So it was going to be much more linear. There are also a couple of tricks that you can play as an author about identity and about withholding information, which you can only do on the page. And the moment the actor's faces appear on the screen for the first time, you eliminate the possibility of some of that trickery. So I knew he was going to have to do revelations in a different way. But yeah, to answer your question, I was absolutely thrilled. I thought it was genius, actually, the way the book was kind of dismantled and then put back together. Mm. And then the mood was so similar to the book. And it was very true to the spirit of the book, I think. Mm. It was
because go from thousands of words to how long would a script be? It's really contracting.
It really is, yeah. Mm. And yet, TV eats plot.
Yes.
You need something happening constantly, whereas in a book you can really go into someone's mind and it can be quite discursive and it can be, it can be quite slow. You can really play with the pace a lot in a book. But on TV it needs those beats, they have those beats. And, with a commercial channel like ITV, you've got also three ad breaks. So you need a kind of mini cliffhanger before each ad break as well. And so just the structure and the pacing are quite different, but fascinating. I think it's really helped me with my writing my novels, actually, to sort of consider pace in a different way, because I'm really, I'm such a I'm such an untrained writer. I'm very instinctive. I've never studied how you're supposed to write a novel, how you're supposed to put together a crime thriller. I literally just do what feels right. And so, it's really made me look at my work and think, oh, actually, I can see why people say it's a slow burn, because with my books, there's a lot of setting up and there's a lot of unease in the first half, and then things start to happen. Mm. You know, it often boom, boom, boom. Whereas on TV, you don't have the luxury of the first half just being about guesswork. You need things happening quite quickly. Yeah. So it's been a really fascinating, sort of insight for me as a writer.
Do you think it's changed you as a writer? Do you think that The Only Suspect is a different book because now you're thinking about seeing it on the screen?
No, I've tried not to do that. I mean, as I say, I think I have been, it's been instructive and I think it has helped me just sort of get things going a bit earlier. But no, if anything, The Only Suspect was, as I was writing, I was thinking this would be quite hard to do on TV because of the, without giving too much away for those who haven't read the book, it's got two strands and one's in the present day and one's in 1995 on the cusp of sort of cool Britannia and in London. And you're not sure for quite a while what the connection is between the two strands. It did feel like a novelist's novel. It was, when I was writing it, it felt like I was thinking, oh, I bet writers will enjoy this one because, there's quite a bit of narrative trickery. It's written as a novel. It's not written for the screen at all.
So do you think about the reader when you're writing, or do you try and put that out of your mind as well? Because I guess for you, it's going to be, it has to be right for you before I guess you expect the reader to like it. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think the relationships are always there in my life between me and the reader. So I can't say that I disregard the reader when I'm writing. But with the first draft, I tend to just get it done and see if it works. And then when the editing process starts, that's when I start to think about the reader a bit more because editors are thinking from a reader's point of view. Mm. And that's why the relationship is so important and so special. So that's when they will say, well, you know, I don't think the readers are going to remember that this was said back then, or I don't think the readers are going to get anything out of this subplot, so should we consider scrapping it? So that tends to be sort of at the editing stage when I'll really think about how it might feel for someone to sit down and open this book. But ultimately, at the idea stage and the first draft stage, I just have to do what I want to do and hope that I can pull readers along with me. And I do now have, you know, a lovely core set of readers who, you know,
trust me. Yeah.
It's new readers. It's what new readers think that I guess is the scary thing.
When we were in lockdown, I haven't asked an author this, but it's just come to mind now. When we were in lockdown, so of course, did you have a book out in that time?
Yeah, I had two actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And both with a hardback and a paperback. So it was kind of the lost years, really.
Yeah. And you didn't do any publicity, obviously, or you weren't out and about meeting readers.
No,
it's interesting,
it was
isn't
all on
it?
Zoom.
Yes. It would have been all on Zoom. So now that we're out about again, I wonder how much that feedback influences what we write or what you write.
Yeah, it is. It's the energy, really, actually.
Yes.
Because I think that what I found, and, you know, of course, I'm sure it's the same for almost everyone, that it just didn't, I lost sight of what, you know, the purpose of what I was doing in lockdown. On the one hand, it was, you know, it was therapeutic, and I think it saved my sanity, actually, to be able to create a world that I had control over, you know, at a time when we were so uncertain and had no control whatsoever over the real world. But I really missed the energy of live events, meeting readers, and also, you know, interacting with other authors. And it, because it's only then that you kind of, you feel the excitement and the joy of just working in culture and the arts and literature and stories. You just see how important it is in society when you look out at an audience and everyone's fired up and, you know, people have got great questions and, you know, we're interpreting the world. I mean, my books always have a social commentary element. They're, you know, it sounds a bit grand to say they're state of the nation, but for me, they're state of the nation. This is how I'm responding to 21st century life in London or in the UK. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, chimes with my readers. And so I kind of, you know, I just couldn't sort of draw on that energy in the same way.
Mm. And so I think
it's not something I'd like to repeat.
No, none of us would. And I think too, I think readers interpret things in so many different ways as well. Like I've often been to events and thought, oh, I didn't think that at all. And I often wonder what the author is thinking too, where the author was going with that. But you're right. I think, you know, being out there and being lucky enough to for authors to tour and readers, you know, to connect, there's an energy.
Yeah. It's a really lovely relationship, actually. Yes. And you do, and through social media, you know, I'm very attuned to the evils of social media, but I also totally appreciate the, you know, the how it facilitates, you know, those sorts of quite intimate, you know, sort of exchanges between author and reader. Because, you know, if you happen to both be online at the same time with 5 minutes to spare, you can have a lovely exchange.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And I think it means a lot to both parties. But in terms of how readers interpret the stories, I mean, I've always found that really fascinating. And at first, my position was very, well, that's not what I meant. And my, you know, because I'm the creator, I'm the one who judges what the book means. But I've long let go of that idea. And now I think it's part of the magic of you know what we do is to see how differently your stories are interpreted. And you know, of course, you know what you forget about when you're writing is that every single person comes to the reading process with their lives and their experiences. So they might have literally experienced what you're describing, or they might never have considered it in a million years, and you know, just literally take your interpretation as gospel. So I find it just wonderful, and you know, particularly in terms of character, because I'm constantly asked, you know, why I'm writing dislikable characters or how I write dislikable characters, and my answer is, well, I don't dislike them.
That's right.
It's fascinating for me that people consider so many of my characters, you know, incredibly ambiguous and, you know, sort of and dislikable. You know, it's like, oh my God, I was kind of, you know, morbidly pulled into their story, but I didn't like them. And I find that hilarious because I obviously love them, even my evil characters.
Well, and also there's an emotion. That's what you want. You want one or the other. I mean, you want them to feel something, don't you? We're out of time, Louise.
Oh, okay.
It was such a great conversation. Really, really enjoyed it. We hope to see you in Australia one day.
Yeah, well, actually, I am coming over to Australia on holiday probably next January. It would be great to meet up and meet some Aussie readers.
Yeah, come and see us. Thank you very much for your time. The book is called The Only Suspect.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.